Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. From the seacoast home where John Paul Jones prepared for battle to Robert Frost's farm, New Hampshire boasts several of the roughly 15,000 small historic house museums scattered across the country. And that is more than the number of McDonald's. Some of these private homes-turned-museums draw huge crowds, like George Washington's Mount Vernon home in Virginia. Others, like the Tobias Lear House here in Portsmouth, are open only a few hours a week in the summer. Many draw fewer than 5,000 visitors a year and operate on tiny budgets. The combination of flagging interest and funding has led to a fairly incendiary argument, even among preservationists, over the value of keeping them open. Ruth Graham wrote about the Great Historic House Museum debate for the Idea section of the Boston Globe. Ruth, welcome back to Word of Mouth.
Thank you.
What accounts for such low attendance rates, do you think?
Well, it's tough to say. I mean, the obvious answer is, there are many more distractions and a lot of more competition for entertainment dollars and eyeballs. I think part of it, too, is that there's just not as much investment in public history. So some of the great historical sites of the 20th century, Colonial Williamsburg, Greenfield Village, were built by these titans of industry. So Henry Ford and the Rockefellers, those kinds of people just aren't investing in public history anymore. So that's another factor, too. And then a lot of it is these places have been limping along on these low budgets for many years now and haven't been innovating, haven't been sort of reaching out to the communities around them as they are now. And that puts them in a tough spot.
How are they funded generally?
Most of them are run by small local historical societies. Historically, it might be a women's auxiliary or a women's group. But small groups, and a lot of them sort of single purpose, so dedicated to maintaining and running these small historic homes.
So there's a big debate now about whether or not these small historic house museums should be kept open. So how many are in danger, do we know?
There is. It's hard to say, again, because so many of them are run by small independent groups. There's not a great up-to-date count of how many of them exist or exactly what their financial status is. But there is widespread understanding in the preservation community and the museum community that a lot of these places are really struggling. So that's been a conversation over the last decade or so. And then a year ago, the president of the National Trust for Historic Preservation gave a major speech in which she said, okay, we've talked about this enough. It's time for action. Mm. And a lot of these places really do need to think about either repurposing, selling to a private owner, or just closing down.
So what are the arguments against that?
Well, I think there are a lot of arguments against that, at least from a sentimental perspective. So I certainly understand the National Trust and similar critics' arguments from a sort of pragmatic economic point of view. That said, I think there are very good arguments that these places, and a lot of them, are worth saving. Even the bad ones, I think, are not bad. They're telling very local stories, very quirky, strange stories that wouldn't get told in a lot of instances. They're telling domestic stories, the stories of how these houses operated, what daily life was like. They're telling women's stories. And a lot of them are serving very small communities that don't have a lot of other museum resources.
And for rural communities, maybe the only thing going on in town.
Exactly.
In some places. Well, so how do critics account for places like Mount Vernon, which are enormously popular? Is it just that they have to have a big story attached to them?
I think that's a big part of it. Mount Vernon is kind of the exception that proves the rule. It was the first historic house museum saved in the 1850s by one of these women's auxiliary groups that banded together specifically to save Mount Vernon. And it still is, I believe, the most popular historic house museum in the country. And it's attached to George Washington, right? So it still has a massive sort of celebrity figure at the center of the story it's telling. And a lot of these very prominent presidents' homes are doing well, too. So the Hermitage in Nashville is this kind of amazing site. And there are plenty of those examples. But there are something like 15,000 small historic house museums in the country, which is just an astonishing number. And most of them are telling stories that are much more obscure than that and aren't necessarily going to bring visitors back over and over and over.
Or as you pointed out in your article, there are two Franklin Pierce, also a former president, homes here in New Hampshire, sort of competing against each other.
There are. And I've been to both of them and I love both of them, but I don't know how many people are in that club with me. And I don't know how big, you know, the Franklin Pierce fan club is at this point, but they're both worth visiting.
Well, tell us a little bit about the sort of typical experience of these small historic house museums.
Well, the basic template, and of course this varies, but there's often a volunteer docent, sometimes dressed up in period costume, who will lead you on a guided tour, you know, with a small group, and you sort of squeeze your way down these old hallways and up, you know, old staircases, tiny staircases built for much smaller people. And you peer into rooms that are set up with antique furnishings, usually behind a velvet rope, so it's not a hands-on experience. You wind your way through and you're sort of told the story of the family at the center of the house. And then you end up in a little gift shop. You know, it's not a very time-intensive experience. And the quality, it varies widely, but really it's always so charming.
Have any small historic house museums been able to kind of turn it around? Any great examples of innovation creating visitorship?
There's a great example in Massachusetts, in Lenox, Massachusetts, the Mount, which was Edith Wharton's country home, which was on the brink of bankruptcy just about 5 years ago, maybe a little more, and has really turned itself around back, you know, on the road to solvency by doing ghost tours. They do concerts. They have a lecture series, just doing a lot more programming. They've also taken down their velvet ropes. And it seems like they've really turned it around 180.
I admit, it's kind of like the national parks to me, you know, that I don't always visit them, but I just love knowing that they are there. There's something about driving past those historic markers or placards. Don't always pull over, but there's something that grounds you in a way.
Absolutely. It would be sad to see too many of them disappear.
So what purpose do the historic homes serve beyond being a museum for people to visit? I mean, it seems to speak to localism, community.
Yeah, and I think there is something actually sort of very 21st century about that. We're kind of returning to a moment of valuing the local, the individual, the, you know, artisanal museum experience. Some of these places, you know, that are converting away from being traditional historic house museums are now becoming community centers, and are kind of opening their doors to a wider and broader, although still local audience, and sort of being used in new ways.
Any way to get people excited to visit them as purely historic homes?
I would just say that no matter what, you know, if you see a sign for one of these places and you pull off the highway and you go in, you are guaranteed to find some kind of special local story that you didn't know about before. And even the places, I kind of love that not all of them are these hyper-professionalized, you know, perfect places with the edges rounded off. A lot of them are just strange little spots, and you're guaranteed to get a great little story there.
Ruth Graham is a New Hampshire-based writer and a contributing writer for the Boston Globe Ideas section. You'll find a link to her article, The Great Historic House Museum Debate. It's on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. There are a number of historic house museums here in New Hampshire. The Concord home of Christian Science founder Mary Baker Eddy, or the farmhouse where Robert Frost lived for 11 years. And two, count them, two house museums dedicated to America's 14th president, Franklin Pierce. When we come back, we'll get a look inside the home of one of New Hampshire's most famous and most reclusive celebrities, J.D. Salinger. That's after the break, when Word of Mouth continues.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. J.D. Salinger was famously private, and his privacy was frequently and famously invaded by photographers, journalists, curiosity seekers, filmmakers, and fans of his landmark novel, The Catcher in the Rye. That Salinger lived in Cornish, New Hampshire is well known. Less known is that Salinger had two homes in Cornish. The first he lived in for 14 years and sits directly behind the second. NHBR's Sean Hurley spoke to the current owner of the first house about her longtime neighbor, J.D. Salinger.
Critics like to say we shouldn't make too much of it. But on January 1st, 1953, J.D. Salinger followed the only dream Holden Caulfield ever had and escaped from the pressure cooker of New York City and moved into a falling-down barn on a rocky knoll in Cornish, New Hampshire.
And I'd build me a little cabin somewhere with the dough I made and live there for the rest of my life.
There was no running water in the cabin Salinger found. No bathroom, no heat. But there was land and a view. Hills and valleys and mountains in the distance.
He bought it, I was always told, with the proceeds from Catcher in the Rye.
That's Joan Littlefield, the home's current owner.
And then a few years after that, he married. And when they started having children, he added on to the original house. But at some point, he built the house down the road on abutting land.
After Salinger and his wife Claire divorced in 1967, Claire took ownership of the cottage, and he moved into the house he'd live in for the remainder of his life. In 1983, Joan Littlefield and her husband Jim bought the original cottage.
The minute we moved in to the house, he called and he welcomed us to the neighborhood, and he said, "If you ever need anything, get in touch with me. We're neighbors now."
Joan had never read a word of Salinger.
I became curious afterward, because he was a lovely, lovely neighbor. When I did read Catcher in the Rye, I read it all at one reading.
Did it surprise you reading the book and then knowing the person?
No, it didn't. I felt there was a strong vein of despising hypocrisy, and you felt it in his conversations.
From time to time, Joan would give Salinger a tour of his former home.
I think that he was completely indifferent to it. I don't think that houses and material things had any appeal for him. He had some interesting little paradoxes in his life that I observed. For instance, you know, that he seems to not have an interest in material things. Yet, in his own way, he always looked snappy. Flannel-y and plaid-y and vest-y.
Joan heads up the stairs into the apartment above the garage.
His son said that his father occupied this place during their breakup.
Was there anything here when you came that was left from Salinger?
Oh, yes, yes. In this crawl space-like attic, we found boxes of papers and some potentially probably valuable things in his own writing. I don't know what to say without getting too personal.
What will you do with it?
I wish that I could auction it off for $1 million.
The secret boxes were not on the premises, but the secret tunnel connecting the house to the garage was.
That seems to be one of his trademarks. He has one in the house up there, too. I mean, I was really surprised that he would show me through his private tunnel, but he took me right on down through the basement and through the tunnel and out the door to my car. He was very, very gentlemanly.
Joan used to read at night in the loft where Salinger once slept.
See, I was a real night owl, and I used to come up here because I'd read at night. And do you know that beautiful branch out there? It is a broken branch. We should have cut it years ago. But I could not bear to cut this branch because it shed the most wonderful filtered moonlight.
From the loft, Joan heads out to her favorite spot.
I call this my sacred garden. I don't know why.
There are flows of hemlock, honeysuckle, fern.
Linton rose. But you see, a fern has taken up residence near.
In the center of the sacred garden, a square white stone.
It's just a big hunk of marble. We brought it from the other house we lived in. I don't know if it was going to be a step to something. It isn't a tomb.
For a moment, Joan Littlefield's sacred garden metaphors tangle into a riddle. The rose hidden beneath a fern. The marble stone that may be a step, but isn't a tomb. The broken branch no one dares cut, because it shed the most wonderful filtered moonlight. For nearly 60 years, J.D. Salinger lived on this hill, in two separate houses, privately and famously, and as quietly as he could.
Do you think he ever wanted to leave the area and go hide away from all of this?
I think he loved it here. I think he had as much protection and love in this community that he could get anywhere. Where would you go?
For Word of Mouth, I'm Sean Hurley.
You can take a look at the photographs of J.D. Salinger's former home in Cornish, New Hampshire, which was recently put on the market for an asking price of $679,000. Pictures at wordofmouthradio.org. Earlier in the show, we talked about historic house museums. Well, now we're moving into a museum in Croatia that has little to do with history and everything to do with broken hearts. Shannon Service has the story.
Ooh, slip out the back, make a new plan.
There are lots of ways to break up. Like, say, writing a letter on a piece of glass and then smashing it with a hammer. Or riding a bike out the door and never coming back. In Croatia, there's a whole museum dedicated to spectacular breakups and couples that quietly fell apart. The museum is a clean, modern space with white walls and polished concrete floors. Items are displayed hip to shoulder height, pink fuzzy handcuffs, antique pocket watches, and a papier-mâché bodice that a man asked his soon-to-be ex-girlfriend to wear while making love.
It's beautiful because whenever you think you're bizarre or you're acting strangely, then you come here and you see there are people acting even more bizarre and even more strange, and that's all normal.
Damir Makovina came to the Museum of Broken Relationships on the very first day it opened. His favorite item is a wooden-handled axe that's simply nailed to the wall. It was donated by a woman who found out her girlfriend was cheating on her.
Every day it takes a piece of furniture and then smash it to the pieces and then...
And then the girlfriend comes back for the furniture and the woman says...
Here is your furniture. It's fun.
Why does that one appeal to you?
Because I did that similar thing once, actually, you know, destroyed everything when she left. My friend even went far, he burned everything. To make a big bonfire of all her stuff.
The Museum of Broken Relationships was started by a couple that broke up. Olinka Vištika and Dražen Grubišić met, fell in love, moved in together, and...
We broke up.
Basically.
And then we were sitting at the house, looking at all the stuff. And it's okay when you have a TV and a VCR and stuff like that. That's easy. Like, okay, you can take this, I'll take that. But what about the little wind-up bunny?
The little wind-up bunny is about 5 inches tall. Sometimes when Olinka came home at night, she'd open the door and find the wind-up bunny marching in circles in the entryway. So there they were, at night, at their kitchen table, looking at this bunny, when Olinka said offhandedly, "Wouldn't it be nice if you
had a place where you could go and just let it go?"
So they decided to apply for an art festival with this idea of an exhibit of breakup items from couples who walked the plank. And to their complete amazement, it was accepted. And not only that, it was a hit. Next thing they know, they're traveling nonstop, putting up installations in Manila, Berlin, San Francisco. The media went nuts.
The scattered objects left in the wake of a breakup. Sometimes they're all that remains of a romantic disaster.
And as they traveled, two things became clear. One, these items need a permanent home. And two, the collection contained a few stars, items that people around the world flocked to and were moved by, like, for instance, the leg. The leg, a prosthetic limb, was donated by a Croatian soldier who lost his original leg during the war in Yugoslavia.
We were under sanctions and you could not import certain materials. And in the hospital, he met a social worker
who helped him get the materials they needed from Germany. The two made the leg together and fell in love. But the leg lasted longer than the love. The soldier says it was made of sturdier material. Psychiatrists believe that attachment is a healthy, biological part of love. There's actually a part of the brain that only monogamous mammals have that seems to connect us so strongly to our partners. So, of course, it's painful when that person leaves.
The common perception is that you are suffering, and what you have to do, you have to stop suffering. But suffering is okay, you know, if you are just happy and watching TV and eating your pizza and not thinking about anything. I've become a better person after a couple of breakups, you know, especially this one with Rajan.
You just slip out the back, Jack. Make a new plan, Stan. You don't need.
For Northgate Radio, I'm Shannon Service.
Get yourself free. Hop on the bus, Gus.
After a quick break, A Craftsman's Legacy, a new show on public television, examines the art and tradition of making goods by hand. That's when Word of Mouth continues after the news.
You don't need to be coy, Roy. You just listen to me. Hop on the bus, Gus. You don't need to discuss much.
Word of
Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of
Mouth. Word of
Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of
Mouth.
Word of
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Nothing lasts forever, but in a world filled with cheap, disposable goods available from any big box store in America, you've got to appreciate quality handmade goods that are destined to live for generations. Eric Gorgeous knows what it takes to make something that lasts. He builds custom motorcycles from the wheels up, and he's host of a new show on public television called A Craftsman's Legacy. From goldsmiths to saddle makers to glassblowers, Eric interviews and observes some of the most skilled old-school craftspeople as they practice and pass on their skills to a new generation of artists. Eric Gorgeous, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Now, you make a really good point. In just the first few minutes of the first episode, that the old days of shop class seem to be disappearing. So what is happening to the kinds of handmade craft work that you talk about on the show?
You know, I think what's happening is that, especially in the States, we don't really have an appreciation for craftsmen necessarily anymore. I think people are so used to being able to, you know, go online and just click, 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 and, you know, it's at their doorstep the next day, that a lot of people forget that there's still people in our society that they make their living with their hands, and everything they do, they put their heart and soul into.
And you're a craftsman yourself. You build motorcycles. How did that experience inform where you wanted to go with this show?
My whole experience with building motorcycles, you know, I found my way to it in life. It's not what I always did. I was actually in a corporate environment for a long time, and I really, really enjoyed what I did. But over time, I ran into some medical issues, and it really made me think about what I was doing with my life and where I wanted to go with it. And one thing that I always appreciated was making things and working with my hands. And I just put my notice in and left.
Yeah.
And took an apprenticeship to become a metal shaper. I didn't want to be constricted by other people's designs. I wanted to make whatever I could think or dream of. So that's what I did.
Well, that's quite a transformation. Is that what you're hoping to inspire other people to think about, making things with their hands? Or are you holding these craftspeople up as someone to admire?
A little bit of both, honestly. You know, one of the things that I like to say about the show is that, you know, we want to inspire people to think about working with their hands again. And because a lot of people sit back and they watch it and they're like, oh, man, I'd love to do that. I wish I could do it. And I'm always telling them, I'm like, man, you could do that. There's no secret sauce here. It's just putting time in.
Well, let's hear a little bit from The Craftsman's Legacy. In the first episode, you speak with woodworker John Wilson, who is also a teacher. Now, here's what he had to say about teaching his craft.
You know, the old adage is, you can't take it with you. That is, your material things, you're going to be in a coffin someplace, and this is all it.
Yes.
But you know what you do take with you? It's your knowledge, if you haven't shared it.
Really interesting point, that the best craftspeople don't possess their knowledge. They don't keep it. What does that mean for you?
That's everything to me. it's just really important, I think. You know, it's so selfish to work with your hands and not share that with others and not enlighten other people's lives with that, you know?
Well, it's one thing to make something, but I think of that whole shop class as Soulcraft kind of book, you know, that movement,
yes,
the maker movement, that there's something deeper that's being touched here, not just creating a product. What do you think, after speaking with several different craftspeople, you're getting at in a deeper way?
You know, it sort of speaks to your soul. I mean, for thousands of years, we've made things with our hands. We've had to survive. Even if you've never been exposed to that environment in your life, and at 40 years old, you start working with wood turnings or ceramics or beadwork or whatever you want to do, I think that almost goes back to your heritage. And, you know, you remember that and see the joy in it.
Well, there is the product, of course, that we see as, you know, viewers, as consumers, that we can appreciate. And for some of these skills, glass blowing, I'm thinking of, it is easy to see the artistry, the creativity. But there's also a deeply technical aspect that you can't always see from the showroom. And here's an example. Glassblower April Wagner, a clip from episode 2 of A Craftsman's Legacy, a new show on public television.
There's a lot of chemistry and physics involved with melting the glass and controlling the temperature. And a lot of the equipment that I use is handmade. So then you have to understand a little bit about metal. You have to understand a little bit about ceramic castables. So the building of a shop and the maintenance of that shop is a whole layer of understanding that has nothing to do with actually working the glass.
We're talking to Eric Gorgeous. He is host of a new show on public television called A Craftsman's Legacy. Do you think April sees herself as an artist, as a craftsman? I'll use that term generally. and what do you think of that divide after hosting this show and speaking to so many artisans?
That's a question I asked every single craftsman I worked with, was how do they see themselves? Do you see yourself as a craftsman or as an artist? Some people, you know, immediately they would say, well, I see myself as a craftsman, no doubt. Mm-hmm. And others, April herself, you know, she said, I'm an artist. A few people said both. It's not a black and white type question. There's no right or wrong to it. It's just perception and how they see themselves. You know, I see myself personally as a craftsman.
What do you think that difference is? Why do you think it's so hard to hop on? Is there a line in the sand?
I don't think there is a line in the sand. No, you know, some people will say, you know, you're an artist if you sign your work and others can see it. You know, you're a craftsman if you sign your work and others can't see it readily. To be honest with you, I think everybody that we featured is a little bit of both.
You've hit on something, too. I'm going to just try and illustrate this point with Sharon and Tom Caldwell. This is a husband and wife team, and they make beautiful saddles that strike me as kind of the definition of old school. Here's a clip. There's Tom Caldwell talking about why they do what they do.
Not only do we take pride in what we do, but we're also proud of the fact that you appreciate it, that you appreciate our effort. That, you know, if we're generic, that makes something that's common, that's ordinary, or whatever the case may be, where's the pride? Who cares?
So I'm going to go back to one of the things that you talked about, sort of whether or not the artists or the craftspeople need to broadcast it. All the people that you spoke with, despite having highly advanced skills and artistry, all seem pretty humble.
Oh, absolutely.
Why do you think that is?
I just think that's the way most craftsmen are, to tell you the truth. I don't know. I think they just have a pride and respect for what they do and who they are. And they're not worried about sharing that knowledge, and they're not afraid of sharing that knowledge, you know. And I think with that comes being humble, you know. Everybody talked about the legacy involved with what they're doing. And some of them really regarded it higher than others, I think, you know. For John Wilson, for instance, it was very important to him to expand that knowledge and to write books and videos and share that knowledge with as many people as possible. And other people, you know, I worked with a stone carver in Illinois, and he was very aware that, you know, everything he builds will last hundreds of years. But he was also so humble in that when I asked him, what can you tell me about your legacy? He said, you know, I don't think about it much ever.
Well, you got to try your hand at doing a little of each of the crafts that you featured on the show. Which was the most difficult for you to pick up on the fly?
You know, I think I stumbled with a lot of them. Ceramics or pottery mm-hmm. was definitely probably the hardest thing for me.
Was this on a wheel?
It wasn't. Yeah. No, we didn't use a wheel. I made a teapot. And it was sort of difficult for me because I'm so used to working with metal. It took me a minute to, you know, figure out how soft that was and how pliable it was. So yeah, that was a challenge for me.
Will we be seeing your teapot for sale, Eric?
I doubt it. I don't think it'll hold tea, actually.
Well, Eric Gorgeous, best of luck on the new show, and thank you for speaking with us.
Oh, thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Eric Gorgeous is host of the new show from American Public Television. It's called A Craftsman's Legacy. It's on Saturdays at 5:30 here on New Hampshire Public Television. And there's a link to view some back episodes. That's at wordofmouthradio.org. Now stay with us. After the break, we're going to look back to the very first craftspeople and the very first handmade tool, the Acheulean hand axe. We'll wield that when Word of Mouth continues. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Before the break, we heard a case for making sure that enduring traditions of handmade craftsmanship won't be lost to time. Now to the creation of the very first human tool to be passed down from generation to generation. Roman Mars of 99% Invisible brings us the story.
In the beginning, there was design. At least according to designer and author Will Lidwell.
Design is the oldest human discipline, older than humanity itself.
And Will believes that in this oldest of old disciplines, everything ever designed,
spaceships, buildings, pyramids, weapons, clothing, artwork, everything,
can be traced back to a single designed object, the first designed object.
This is as close to a Genesis object as we have. I mean, this is where it all began.
This is where it all began.
If design had its own Cosmos series, this would be episode one. I think this is the greatest, grandest, like most interesting story in the field of design. It has it all. Mystery, intrigue, controversy.
We are on the edge of our seats, Will.
Wait for it. I need like the drum roll here. The first designed object was the Acheulean hand axe.
The Acheulean hand axe, ladies and gentlemen. Actually, it doesn't look like an axe at all. There's no handle. There's no metal. Honestly, it should be called the Acheulean pointy hand rock.
A hand axe is made of rock, and it's teardrop shaped. And if you join your hands together as if to pray, fingers together and thumbs in, this is almost the exact shape and size of an Acheulean hand axe.
The term Acheulean refers to where the first specimens were found, which was a dig site in Saint-Acheul, France. But they've been found in a lot of other places.
We find that Acheulean tools are found almost exclusively in Africa, in Europe, and South Asia.
This is Terence Deacon.
I'm Terence Deacon. I'm a professor of biological anthropology at the University of California, Berkeley.
And Berkeley has a whole bunch of samples of these hand axes.
There's another hand axe. You can see that it's not quite so symmetric and nice, although it's sharp at this edge.
Some are sharp all along the entire perimeter, some aren't. Some are perfectly symmetrical, and some are not. But those hand axes in the UC Berkeley basement aren't actual primordial hand axes. These are replicas made by graduate students.
Yes, graduate students. In fact, there have been courses here in which one of the challenges is to make tools.
And the point of this challenge for the graduate students is to see how involved this process is in making one of these pointy rocks, the way the early humans would have.
You break off big pieces with large rocks and large strikes, and then you break off these little edges. You shape the edge with smaller pieces.
I just love the image of a bunch of grad students sitting around smashing rocks together. And sometimes they have to do it for a while. Someone really practiced at it can make a hand axe in something like 15 minutes to a half hour.
But to make a really fine tool, a really carefully shaped tool, you're probably talking about an hour to 2 hours.
Acheulean hand axes require time, effort, and skill to make. They were a product of a design process, the first design process. But the Acheulean hand axe was not the first tool. The first tool was
basically a rock that is chipped with just a handful of major strikes to produce a few sharp edges. Not very sophisticated tools.
Anthropologists call these Oldowan tools. Our Homo habilis ancestors used them to bash open bones and scrape meat off of them around 2 million years ago, though this kind of technique isn't unique to humans.
This can be done even by South American monkeys, the Capuchin monkeys. They get these large pine nuts and they have hammer stones that they can then lift up and bash these things until they open them. They know what they want to achieve, but they actually simply go out and select something that will accomplish that.
Rather than actually design something.
Chimpanzees in, for example, stripping the leaves and the side branches off a little branch, they can stick it down a termite nest and get the termites to bite it, and so they can eat the termites that way.
So this requires cunning, yes, but craft, not really. So early humans understood the importance of Oldowan tools, those sharp rocks, and they realized that they could fashion more precise tools by sharpening rocks purposefully.
So it's not just adventitious production. Now it's planned production.
So the hand axe is the first designed object, at least that we can find. If there were any, say, wooden tools that our human-like ancestors made, those have long since disintegrated. But even if there are other examples, hand axes are really significant.
With the Acheulean hand axe, with the Acheulean technology showing up, we suddenly now find people making people, and I say they're our ancestors, making tools with an end in mind. They're making them in advance. They almost certainly have to carry them with them. They don't just make them on the spot. They take time to make them. They take thought to make them. And you're shaping them towards a particular shape for some particular use, which we today don't know.
We don't know. We don't know how they were used. That's the crazy mystery here. So this is where we get into the intrigue.
That's Will Lidwell again.
There are ideas, right? So smart people are working on the problem. And there are like three theories.
There are more than three.
If you want me to talk about more theories, I can talk about more theories, but I'll stop at three unless you tell me otherwise.
Will Lidwell has three favorite theories as to why the hand axe appeared.
So, all right, theory number one, right, of how it's used is the multi-tool theory. So theory number one is that the Acheulean hand axe was the original Swiss Army knife, primarily used for butchering meat, but it's also good for breaking open nuts and digging up grubs or whatever else you might need. And so the strength of this theory is that it fits with wear patterns that you see on a lot of the hand axes that are found.
Here's the problem with theory number one. In some cases, the full perimeter of the axe is sharp. And remember, this is a hand axe that you're holding in the palm of your hand. So if you wanted to use it, there would be this sharp blade digging into your palm. Another problem with theory one is that some of the axes are symmetrical, which is a lot of extra effort that isn't really necessary if you're just using it to break up nuts or cut meat.
And so to address some of those problems, we get into theory number two, and this is my personal favorite, the sexy hand axe theory.
The quote-unquote sexy hand axe theory proposes that these tools didn't have a use, per se. They were created mostly as a way of showing off.
Like the feathers of a peacock. The goal wasn't to create a functional tool for butchering, but a symbolic tool for mate attraction. And making these things is really, really hard. Why spend so much time doing it unless you're showing off, right? You're showing the opposite sex what you can do.
But there are a lot of experts who are doubtful of this one, including anthropologist Terence Deacon.
Not all of them are beautiful teardrop shapes. They weren't all that nice and neat and symmetrical. There is one interesting exception, and I mean one.
One beautiful 350,000-year-old exception.
A hand axe was located at the bottom of a kind of well in southern Spain. It looks as though bodies were tossed down here, and one of the things it found in this well, so to speak, it's just a cave well, is a hand axe that was made of a kind of rose quartz looking stuff. Really pretty. And it doesn't look like it was ever used. Not a sexy hand axe, but this may be the first indications that they're beginning to sort of grieve over the death of someone, or that there's some kind of ritual issue here in which a beautiful hand axe is somehow playing a role.
Okay, okay. So Will's third favorite theory is still a really fun one.
Number three is pretty fun. Number three, in a close follow-on to my favorite, to sexy hand axe, is the killer frisbee theory. And so in the killer frisbee theory, right, hand axes were made to be projectiles, so thrown in the fashion of the discus in the Olympics.
A lot of hand axes are found near riverbanks, and so the hypothesis goes that hunters would wait for herds of animals to come, and then they would bombard them with hand axes. This might not be enough to make a kill, but the stones would maim a few and give the hunters an opportunity to charge.
This hypothesis, right, explains why it looks the way it does, right? Why the hand axe is sharp all the way around, why it's so symmetrical, why it's so aerodynamic.
Well, again, not all of them are sharp all the way around and perfectly symmetrical.
Was it used like a frisbee, or was it used like a weapon? I really have my doubts about that. I like the Swiss Army knife view, in part because it looks like it's a one-tool-fits-all. It was clearly something that we see again and again and again and again all over the world. That means it was very effective. And if you don't find a lot of diversity of tools, it was almost certainly used for more than one thing.
But whatever the hand axe was used for, it must have done a really good job, because this basic design was used for a mind-blowingly long time.
Hominid adults were literally teaching hominid children how to make hand axes for more than a million years, passing the knowledge down from generation to generation. And so you compare that to any modern product life cycle, right? It's just crazy long.
So long that our human minds can barely wrap our heads around it.
We have no conception of what that time frame is. You know, our understanding of history is only, what, maybe 5,000, 10,000 years. That's our biggest understanding of history. We're talking about something that stayed the same, a culture that was constant for a million years. That's pretty remarkable.
And no matter what the Acheulean hand axe was actually used for, just the mere existence of a designed object that is so old has huge implications.
I often have students or colleagues think that design's a new field, like a 20th century invention, when in fact it's the most ancient of all academic disciplines. Before there was mathematics or engineering or science or art or music or poetry, before there was philosophy, literature, religion, or even language, there was design.
That story from Roman Mars podcast 99% Invisible. The Acheulean hand axe may have been simple in its design, but as Roman said, its utility lasted more than a million years. Compare that to today's digital technology, and you get a sense of how fast modern design becomes obsolete. Case in point, while Apple was heralding the introduction of its newest disruptive technology last week, the Apple Watch, one of its first big innovations, the classic click-wheel iPod, was quietly phased out at the ripe old age of 13. To get a sense of how quickly things have changed, here's a clip from 2001, when Steve Jobs first introduced the iPod to the world.
What is iPod? iPod is an MP3 music player, has CD quality music, and it plays all of the popular open formats of digital music, MP3, MP3 variable bitrate, WAV, and AIFF. But the biggest thing about iPod is it holds 1,000 songs. For most people, it's their entire music library. That's iPod. I happen to have one right here in my pocket, matter of fact. There it is, right there.
Maybe the strangest bit of forgotten history we discovered when watching this video had nothing to do with rapidly changing technology since 2001. It was Steve Jobs' unlikely music selection and the very first song to be played publicly on an iPod.
And, you know, just pick any song I want to. So let's pick that one. I can change the volume just again by moving the wheel.
That's right, Sarah McLachlan's Building a Mystery, How Times Have Changed.
You come out at night. That's when the air.
That does it for our show today. Thanks so much for listening. And if you do like what you heard, there is much more at wordofmouthradio.org. You can also follow us and send us your feedback or share your ideas for the program on our Facebook page and on Twitter. After all, the most fascinating ideas move around by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Join us for more of them tomorrow at 2 on New Hampshire Public Radio.